Jesus just had this really unique and almost confounding way of talking to people and ushering in his power that caused people to question what in the world he was actually up to. I mean, I think to the moment where he takes his three best friends up a mountain for the Transfiguration, and they see this amazing picture, Moses and Elijah and Jesus, and the only thing that they know to do in the presence of this kind of power is to build a monument. I mean, that's what an emperor on the rise would do, build a statue to himself. And they say, let's do it. And Jesus says, no. I think about Jesus and the quietness of that private home, and he heals that little girl. And he says, but don't speak of it. This power that I've just unleashed on your life is just for you and me. I mean, if the guy was trying to take over political power, wouldn't he want everybody in the city square to know what he was capable of doing? But that wasn't what he was after. Think about the time when they all came to him and they were trying to trick him into talking down Caesar. And they say to Jesus, well, what should we do about our taxes? Jesus says, let me see a coin. He goes, it's got Caesar's picture on it. Give to Caesar what's his. As if to shrug off any opening that he might grab power for himself. It's just not the way that a young king on the rise of a revolutionary takeover behaves. And then I fast forward to the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus is about to be arrested, and his disciple Peter grabs the sword out from one of the soldiers and takes a swipe at the soldier as if to initiate the revolution and the war that they had come to know happens when a new king arrives in town. And Jesus stops him and touches the soldier and heals his ear. There was just something else Jesus was up to. He wasn't interested in building an empire. He was establishing his kingdom. And for 8 years since Disciples Church first started, we have had an unwavering commitment to pressing into the kingdom of God, even when it didn't build our empire. We have this little saying around here that kingdom eats empire for breakfast. And that kind of thinking won't grow the biggest church in town, and it won't make a famous name for ourselves, and fewer people have brand loyalty or knowledge of our logo. But boy, do we get an opportunity to see the kingdom of God unleashed in our city, around our country through church planting and the 8 church plants we've helped start, and around the world through our Water for Guatemala project. So all this month, as we lead up to our 8th anniversary, we just get to highlight some other kingdom efforts in our area to say, this is what it looks like when you press into the kingdom, even though it might not build your empire. So it is a tremendous honor and privilege on this anniversary month to bring to you one of those such ministries and a person unlike any other you'll ever meet. Would you give a warm disciples welcome to Nancy Atchley from Powerhouse?
Have any light last service, so they hooked me up. You guys are amazing. I will say this, you guys are incredible hosts. You really are. And I feel really at home here, which isn't always the case because Powerhouse is not a conventional church, so I go into church and it feels kind of stiff, but you guys are amazing and you made me feel really welcome. I'm so excited about what God is doing in our city, and I'm excited to be a part of the kingdom here. Because everywhere I go, I get to go into a lot of churches and meet a lot of pastors here in Folsom. And it's really unique. These are some of the most amazing people that are walking with Jesus in the city that I've ever met. I don't know if you're like me, but when I tell people that I'm from Folsom, I get this blank look. And they go, where's that? And then they go, oh yeah, that's the place with the prison. Yeah, you hear that? It's amazing that having been known for a prison all these years, thanks to Johnny Cash, that we are recently becoming known as actually a great place to live. We ranked like, I don't know, number 3, number 5, something like that, of the best places to live. So I see the reputation of our city changing. But truth is, we have been known for years as the place where the prison is, or the end of the world, as Johnny Cash said. And, you know, even though all of us that live here know about the prison, most of us don't know any of the history. And I kind of want to share a little bit of that because it had a big impact on my own life. Horatio Livermore had this dream, and his dream was basically to build Folsom into an empire. He wanted Folsom to be the capital of California. And the way he wanted to do that is he wanted to build a powerhouse that would produce the first long transmission of electricity that had ever been built. And so he had some rich relatives, and they owned land in California, and he talked them into donating that land, to the state of California to build a prison. And in exchange for that big favor, he wanted to be able to use inmate labor to build his powerhouse. So that's exactly what he did. But when the powerhouse was finished, unfortunately, Folsom didn't get any power. The power went to Sacramento, and Folsom was left in the dark with a prison. I believe that God is changing the reputation of our city. And one of the things that God showed us when we were studying the history of the prison and how it got here was that he still wanted to build a powerhouse in Folsom. He still wanted Folsom to be known for power and light, but a different kind of power and light than maybe what Horatio Livermore thought. He wanted a spiritual powerhouse here, and he was going to build it with men and women who had either literally been in prison or figuratively in prison. And I believe that what God is in the process of doing is, instead of being known as a prison town, we're going to become known as a place where people come to get free. I want to tell you a little bit of my story. I was raised in a Christian home, wonderful home, lived in a nice house, in a good neighborhood, and I knew all the right things to do, went to church all my life, and I'll have to be honest with you, by the time I hit my teens, I was kind of bored. And I just really felt like there had to be more out there than just going to church and being good. And so I looked in some other places, experimented with a lot of stuff. And finally, in my 20s, I decided that, no, probably God's way was the best way. But this time, I had a different attitude. And that was, you know what, I'm going to do something really big for God. And that won't be as boring. I'm an adventurer. I just need to do something new and creative. And so that was kind of where I was at. And at the same time that God was doing that in my heart, my husband got transferred to Folsom. We were living in Southern California at the time. And he was hired to work on the construction for the new Folsom prison. So after we moved into our new house, the next day was Sunday morning. And first thing my husband wanted to do is go up to the prison and see the construction site. So got in our car, and back in those days, the women and children used to wait in line on the prison road, waiting to visit their loved ones. And God just did something in my heart that's never happened before or since. I looked at the people, and I just saw their faces and the desperation and the pain. And we were on our way to church, and I'm like, why are we going to church in a building when these hurting people are here? And I turned to my husband, and I said, this is where the church needs to be, ministering to these families. So here I was, I wanted to do something big for God, and God had just given me an idea of what it might be. But God works so differently than we think. And so shortly after that, I was reading my Bible, and I came to Mark 14. It says, Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon, a man who had previously had leprosy. While he was eating, a woman came in with a beautiful alabaster jar of expensive perfume made from essence of nard. She broke open the jar and poured the perfume over his head. Some of those at the table were indignant. Why waste such expensive perfume, they asked. It could have been sold for a year's wages and the money given to the poor. So they scolded her harshly. But Jesus replied, leave her alone. Why criticize her for doing such a good thing to me? You will always have the poor among you, and you can help them whenever you want to, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could and has anointed my body for burial ahead of time. I tell you the truth, that wherever the good news is preached throughout the world, this woman's deed will be remembered and discussed. So I'm reading that, and God speaks to my heart. Are you willing to waste your life on just knowing and loving me instead of this big thing you want to do for me. Mary, we know from John chapter 12, was the sister of Martha. She was always in trouble. She was always in the wrong place at the wrong time. She was the one that was sitting at Jesus' feet while her sister was preparing dinner. Remember her? And here she comes with this bottle of perfume that we're told is worth a year's wages. It was probably her life savings, possibly her dowry, her only hope of marriage. We don't know. And she takes it, she breaks it, and she pours it out on Jesus. Crazy, right? The disciples, the people around are going, what the heck are you doing? The least you could have done was sold it and given the money to the poor. And Jesus says, leave her alone. He says, what she's done is so significant that they're going to be talking about her all over the world. Of the whole crowd that's gathered there in the room, Mary is the only one that on some level understood what was about to happen. Dan talked about this last week. She understood because instead of just being in the room with Jesus, she was present to him. And she understood that Jesus was about to do something that was so much more valuable than anything she could ever give. And so she took what she had and she gave it all to Jesus. That act ended up releasing Jesus' ministry to the world. She anointed him for his burial. And we know that Jesus' death brought more freedom and healing and blessing than any amount of money could have brought. It's interesting that in Jesus' first sermon, he tells us what the poor need. He says, the poor need good news. He doesn't say the poor have food brought to them or clothing brought to them or shelter. He says the poor have good news brought to them. And that experience wrecked my life. It began this quest in me to sit at Jesus' feet and to understand his heart and what he was doing. To waste my life on knowing and loving him so that his ministry could be released through me. And I can tell you that there's been no greater adventure that I've ever found than doing that, and no greater joy. But it's cost me something. We talk about love a lot, and in the church we talk about God's love. But love, real love, is costly. It hurts. And sometimes it hurts a lot. And just about the time that I think I get it, he leads me deeper into understanding his love. I could quote for you John 3:16 ever since I was probably 3 years old, but I'm beginning to understand the kind of love that would drive a God to do something so outrageous as to send his son to die for people. It says, God so loved the world that he couldn't stand it. He gave his only son. That is so incomprehensible that God would send his son to die for a people, most of whom could care less. 3 years later, I was lying in bed and I was complaining to God. Do you guys ever do that? Yeah, some stuff was going on in my life I didn't like. And God just speaks to my heart, why haven't you done what I showed you when you first moved up here? And then I fell asleep and had a dream. Maybe I should tell you, I was 9 months pregnant at the time, and I've learned since then, you're not supposed to listen to your dreams when you're pregnant. They're outrageous, but I didn't know that at the time. So I have this dream that I'm in this place that looks much like Powerhouses today. And people were coming. They were in desperate straits. Some of them were mentally ill. Some of them were addicted. Some of them had been in prison. Some were homeless. And they were just broken. And God was there in this place. And people's lives were being transformed. They were meeting him. They were encountering him. And their lives were being changed. And they were going out from this place. And I saw them streaming in. And then I saw them streaming out. And I saw this earthquake that happened. And when this earthquake happened, what was happening in these people spread to the whole city of Folsom and even to the prison. So what do you do when you have a dream like that? Huh? That's a little crazy. But I knew that God's heart was breaking for the people that were right in my backyard, and I knew I had to go. So I went. I found out about a little old lady that was leading a Bible study with some of the women in the low-income neighborhood that I knew God was calling me to, and I joined her. Auto harp and all. It was so not my style, right? I'm just like, oh my gosh. It was the most uncomfortable thing for me. And yet at the same time, it was the most comfortable thing for me because I knew that I was where God wanted me to be. So I walk in. She says, honey, I've been praying for you for years. She said, I'm too old to do this. And will you take over my Bible study? I had never taught a Bible study. Never. I did not have anything in common with the people there. And I'm like, oh no, you don't understand. I'm just here to kind of see. I think God might be doing something in my heart. And so I hung out there, and a month later she left me. And you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew I was walking with Jesus. I knew he was there with me, and I couldn't find a formula. I looked in the Bible and I looked at what Jesus did, and you know, did you know he doesn't have a formula? He like treats everybody different. Like some people, you know, he tells them go and sin no more. And other people, he says, oh, it's not your sin that got you in this mess. And, you know, he calls out a lady that touches him when he's got all kinds of people touching him. I mean, he just did crazy stuff. He asked for a drink from a lady at a well. And it says that he only did what he saw his father doing. So I knew that in order to do what he was doing, I had to stay present with him. Because I knew that the most important thing was that everybody I met had an encounter with God. And to this day, that's our number one value at Powerhouse. Whether we are handing out a bag of food, whether we are helping someone with a legal issue, whether they're seeing the doctor, or whether they're a resident in our residential program, we want every individual to have an encounter with Jesus Christ. I met Judy. She was one of the first people I ever met. And to tell you how, I mean, I literally did not know what I was doing. I'm not being humble. I really didn't. And Judy needed food. I knew how to do food, right? You go to the grocery store, you buy food. We didn't have a food closet. We just brought her food. And I bring it to her door, have the bags of food. She greets me at the door. She says, thank you. And she says, tell me why I should live. She said, my son beats me up. I'm being evicted from my apartment. She said, my husband's in prison. I just found out I'm pregnant. I am so desperate. And she said, I've had so many miscarriages. I doubt I'm even going to have this baby. And she said, will you pray for me that I carry this baby to term? Well, I didn't even know what to do. So I start praying for her, and I start telling her about Jesus and how much he loves her and how he has a future for her and how there's more to life than what she's known and how he's not angry with her and all of those things. And all of a sudden, this thing starts to build in my heart, faith, okay? And I just start praying, you know, that she's going to carry this baby to term. Now, I don't normally do that, but I just knew that that was what was going to happen. So I'm praying that over her, and I just, you know, Lord, just as a sign that you have a future for her and a hope for her, would you just cause her to carry this baby to term? After I finished praying for her, she says, well, I want to show you what happened to me. And she lifts up her shirt. She had been in a fire in a drug lab, and she was horribly scarred all over her stomach. And I looked at that skin and I went, there is no way that she's going to carry a baby to term, right? There's no way that skin was going to stretch. And I'm like, what have I done, Lord? What have I done? I've gotten this lady's hopes up, and now she's going to lose this baby, and she's going to hate you, and she's going to, you know. Well, she did carry that baby to term, and she named her Jessica Faith. You know, after that, my friends kind of got wind of what I was doing, and they said, you can't be going around in these low-income neighborhoods by yourself and hanging out with gang members. We used to have gangs in Folsom at that time. So they started coming with me and helping me, and we were out on the lawn handing out ice cream cones. Whatever we did, it didn't seem to matter what we did. God led us to have encounters with people, and they would have encounters with him. And other people began to see that happening. And at that time, a church went up for sale in the neighborhood where we were ministering. And the Lord brought us someone who said, we heard what you're doing in that neighborhood and we want to buy that church for you. And that was so exciting because we were out on front lawns. We had rented an apartment. We had probably about 200 people that we were ministering to and nowhere to meet. And so I knew how to do street ministry, but I wasn't sure what to do with the church. But we said, okay, Lord, that's what you're doing. And we purchased what was Calvary Assembly of God Church and opened that up. We became a nonprofit in order to receive that donation. So that's when we became Powerhouse Ministries. Things were going great. We had lots of involvement from the churches in Folsom. They were excited. They were getting involved with us. And then my husband came down with lymphoma and died. That's not supposed to happen, right? And I'm like, Lord, we've given our lives to ministering to primarily widows and orphans, and now you would leave me a widow and our children orphans? What I found out was that I had to live out the message that I was preaching. The people that I was ministering to became my family because I needed them as much as they needed me. They came over to my house with meals, the very people that I had bought food for. They loved on my kids. They held me while I cried. My husband died in November, and for Christmas, they put their money together and they bought me skis because they knew I loved to ski. I have never been so humbled and broken in my life as opening that present, I'll tell you. And what I learned is that love isn't really love until you give the other person the power to hurt you, which means you have to become one of them. And that's been the hardest lesson of all, to allow myself to be humbled again and again, to not put myself in a position above those that I serve, but to recognize my own needs, my own brokenness, and my need for God's grace. I wish I could tell you that I'm done learning that one, but this last year has been the hardest year of my life. Not yet ready to share all of that yet, but I will say this. I wouldn't have made it through it without my Powerhouse family loving on me and supporting me through it. So our family at Powerhouse became a safe place for hurting people, for adults, and for children who didn't have a healthy family. In fact, we would refer to ourselves as foster parents for children that were never removed from their home. We became their holiday celebration. We were the ones they came to when they wanted to play sports and they didn't have money to buy soccer shoes. Whatever it was, whatever they needed, we were their family. And you know, instead of my husband's death hurting the ministry, it grew. And the people said to me, you know, when we first came to Powerhouse, we thought, well, it's easy for you to say that God is amazing and that he's got a future for us because you guys, your lives are perfect. But now that we've watched you go through hell and you're still saying the same thing, we believe you. Who would have guessed it had to be that way? So people were getting saved. The churches were getting more involved. We had weekly support groups for men, women, children, and teens. And we had holiday celebrations, all those things. And then I met Ruthie. Ruthie was addicted to heroin. She came with only the clothes on her back. She had an aunt that lived in Folsom, and so she was staying with her. She had lost custody of all of her six children. And she started coming to our women's group. She met Jesus. She got off heroin. And she got her kids back. Amazing. Her kids were all school-aged, and they started in school, and they were struggling. They had been tossed around a lot, and they weren't keeping up, and Ruthie herself only had a sixth-grade education. So when it came to helping them with their homework, it was really hard. We didn't have STARS program back then, and so Ruthie had to deal with it by herself. And then added to that was the fact that welfare changed their laws then and said, you need to go to work. The only thing Ruthie was qualified to do was work at McDonald's, so that's what she did. Laundry for six children, can you even imagine? But Ruthie didn't have a washer or dryer, so she would steal a shopping cart from the grocery store, load it up, take it to the laundromat in between, going to work and trying to care for her children. Her children, now they were feeling a little settled with mom, so their anger started coming out. And they told her what they thought of all the years that she was using drugs and not there for them. So life became pretty overwhelming for Ruthie, and she did what any reasonable woman would do. She found a man, right? A man who promised her the world, and he came into her life, moved in with her, led her back into her addiction and losing everything again. And my heart was broken when we lost Ruthie. And I began to see that just having people come in to a women's group once a week, or come in and get a bag of food, or stop by for prayer, or to talk wasn't enough. That they needed more support. And I began to ask God about starting a residential program for homeless addicted women and their children. At that same time, one of the women that we hadn't been able to help, she gave birth to her daughter, and immediately CPS took her because mom had used meth during her pregnancy. And so she called me up and she was hysterical and she said, you know, will you take my baby? Because they're going to put her in the system and I can't handle that. So I went to court with her and the judge gave me and my new husband custody of Emily. And we loved on her. We were told immediately that it was going to go to adoption. There was no way they were giving her back to her mom. Her mom had lost two other children to the system. So there was no way. So we began to prepare our hearts for that. It was not something we had planned on doing, but we're like, okay, Lord, this is what you're doing. And a year later, CPS came back and said, we made a mistake in the way we did the legal proceedings, and so we have to return her to her mom. At this stage, her mom was making some very poor decisions, and I had to give her back. And I had to take this little girl that in my heart was my own, hand her back to a woman that was using and allowing all kinds of abuse and unsafe situations in her life. And you know, up to that time, it had been easy to love broken women and to even champion them getting their kids back. But now I had to let this little girl that I loved go into a situation where I knew she was going to be broken. That was hard. And I had always had compassion for the children at Powerhouse that lived in these drug-addicted homes. And I loved on them. But it was totally different than watching the damage happen to Emily up close and personal. One of the gals said to me, she said, now I know that you are really one of us. Because you've taken one of our own into your home and loved her. To have CPS rip this child out of my arms gave me an understanding of the fear and the hopelessness that so many of the women I ministered to felt. I really was one of them. God used these situations in my own life to help me understand what actually changes people. Most programs, they work on changing behavior, and most addicts think that's what they need. I just need to stop using drugs. I need to stop using alcohol. But the reality is you can change behavior for a while, but if you don't change the heart, if you don't change what you believe, ultimately your behavior won't change. And changing the heart takes a lot of time and lots of hard work, and it takes someone willing to look at their past and deal with their unresolved pain. In 2007, the Powerhouse Transformation Center was born. And our Transformation Center is a 2-year residential intensive recovery discipleship program that seeks to rebuild lives from the inside out. Our success rate in dealing with people went from, I don't know, about 20% up to about 80%. It was working. And you know, we began to see some incredible success stories come out of there. But a couple of years ago, God reminded me that his vision is bigger. He doesn't just want sobriety and stability for them. Listen to his heart in Isaiah 61. says, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me, for the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to comfort the brokenhearted and to proclaim that captives will be released and prisoners will be freed. He has sent me to tell those who mourn that the time of the Lord's favor has come, and with it the day of God's anger against their enemies. To all who mourn in Israel, he will give a crown of beauty for ashes, a joyous blessing instead of mourning, festive praise instead of despair. In their righteousness, they will be like great oaks that the Lord has planted for his own glory. They will rebuild the ancient ruins, repairing cities destroyed long ago. They will revive them, though they have been devastated for many generations." God was actually wanting to take those lives that have been destroyed, and he was wanting to heal them and then make them into heroes that would repair cities. I could name off so many women that graduated our program that have gone on to do great things. I was reminded today in the first service when I looked over and saw Colleen. Colleen was here because her son, Jordan, is a part of your congregation. Colleen was in our center probably 7 years ago. She was a meth addict. She was homeless. She had burned every bridge she had in her life, destroyed her family relationships and her relationship with her sons. She met Jesus in a radical way, and he healed her heart and restored her life. And through what happened in her life, both of her sons came to know the Lord. And her nephew came to know the Lord, and her nephew's father and mother. And I don't know how they're all related, because there's complicated relationships. So I'm not even going to tell you all that. But this whole family, God is restoring. Last year, Colleen bought a house. She's in an amazing job. And she and her family volunteer in our youth program, giving hope to children who have parents that are trapped in what Colleen was trapped in. It's amazing. In the midst of all that God was doing with the ladies, something very disturbing was happening with the teens that we work with. Now, most of our teens, a couple of them now and then might have a mom that's in our transformation center, but most of them come from fatherless families, dads in prison or left long ago, moms addicted to drugs or alcohol, or mentally ill, and they're basically raising themselves. So they would come to Powerhouse often as children. They would find out about this God that loves them, that no matter what's going on in their lives, if mom's being abused by her latest lover or what's happening, that God was there with them, that he loved them, that no matter what kind of words they were being called, that God said things about them that were true and wonderful, and they weren't those things that they had been told since they were small. They were beginning to get a picture of what their future might look like. Some of them we were meeting on the continuation school campus where we're there twice a week. Some of them were just coming from the neighborhoods because they heard, and they were meeting Jesus. They were graduating from high school. I mean, that was huge. And they had dreams for their life. I remember when I first started the ministry and I had a group of junior hires, the boys said, "I want to go to prison like my dad and like my grandfather." And the girls said, "I want to get pregnant so that I can show that somebody loves me." And yet these kids, they wanted to be veterinarians and doctors, and they had real dreams for their life. But something was happening. When they turned 18 and they no longer had a welfare check to give to mom to support a drug habit, she was saying, "Get out, get a job to support me, or leave." And so these kids that we had discipled all these years were ending up on the streets, or crashing at the drug dealer's house, or working dead-end jobs at McDonald's and not going on to college. And we just began to cry out to God and go, "God, we can't do this anymore unless you make a way for full adoption, where we can actually take these kids to the next level and help them launch the dreams that they have." So a year ago, we launched our Ignite Leadership Academy. It's a 2-year program for 18 to 24-year-old young men. We had to start with men because that's what we had the majority of. And We teach them life skills because some of them don't know basic life skills. They work an internship at Powerhouse so that we can teach, how do you actually deal with a boss? You know, how do you show up for work? How do you cooperate with others? They're involved in life coaching and leadership training, and God is showing them how he's uniquely gifted them. He's growing them up. We have a class which we actually call adulting, and that's been real challenging for some of them. But he's already using them powerfully. They're having a great impact on their peers and our youth group in showing them what really is possible. It's possible to get out of the cycle that they've been trapped in. They're powerful leaders on the continuation school campus, and they're affecting their families. Already we're seeing, we've only been doing this a year, and we're already seeing their families going, hey, this stuff's real. What's going on here? They're coming to church with their kids. But they're doing something else too. They have this boldness in them that they want to change our city. And one of our young men, he had been, he would actually go and buy alcohol from one of the local convenience stores, and then he would get it, pass it out to all of his friends. And he said, I want to go back to that convenience store, and I want to tell them it's not okay for you to do this anymore. I know you're selling to underage youth because I was one of them. And you're not going to do that in our city, or I'm going to report you to the police. So he asked us to go with him, and that's exactly what he did. He said, not in my town. I am so excited about what God's doing at Powerhouse. He's changing lives. And we have learned that while we can give out a sleeping bag or a bag of food or whatever, what we really want to do is we want to find those that are ready to let God do whatever he needs to do to change them from the inside out. And then we want to walk through that journey with them and enable them to do that. And we want to lead them into an encounter with Jesus Christ. We want to become family to them so that they can know what it is to have loving and caring relationships. And then we want to empower them to be heroes that change our city. I want to invite you guys to join us. Love to have you guys come and volunteer in our programs. We have opportunities from everything from answering the phone to making a meal to actually we provide training for you to become a relapse prevention counselor if that's what you want to do. You name it, we have opportunities. We need your prayers because, frankly, the work we're doing, there's a lot of warfare because the enemy doesn't like that people are being rescued and brought into this place of being empowered as heroes. And we need financial partners. We increased our budget by $90,000 this year when we started the Leadership Academy. It was a faith step, and we're believing God's going to bring it in, but it was a big risk. And so we have a table out there, and I'd love for you to stop by. We have some literature we can give you. We can put you on our mailing list, and just love to have you guys get more involved. Let me pray for you. Lord, I just thank you for what you're already doing here in these men and women. And God, how you're already stirring their hearts. And God, I pray that you would lead them into that place where they're willing to waste their lives on you. Lord, teach them what it means to be present to you and to see what you're doing and then follow after you. God, I pray even today that that little dreams or thoughts that people have had here, God, that you would just ignite those, that they would begin to burn in their hearts. And Lord, that you would open doors for them to walk in to whatever it is that you're calling them to do. God, raise up heroes in this place that will change our city. Lord, we ask you, God, change the reputation of this city, that no longer would it be known as a place with a prison that's the end of the world, but it would be known as a place of new beginnings where there's freedom, where anyone can come and meet you and not be trapped in their past, but be led into a glorious future. In Jesus' name, amen.
Just say thank you to Nancy for leading us in the word today.